right, here we go, everyone. Welcome to a very special episode of Hub Talk, recorded live at Faculty Retreat 2019, here on the beautiful Chemeketa Eola campus. How's everybody doing this morning? Yeah. We excited for fall term? Maybe. I'm Bill Hamlin, and I'm here with Colin Stapp, Dr. Jessica Howard, and of course many of our wonderful Chemeketa faculty in attendance. For our new faculty and anyone who might not be familiar with our podcast here, Colin and I work at the Center for Academic Innovation and co-host Hub Talk throughout the year with conversations about various trends in technology and teaching.
Oh yeah, it's my part, isn't it?
On to you.
Yeah, on to me. Okay. As Bill mentioned, Hub Talk is our teaching and learning and technology podcast series. We cover all aspects of teaching practice, along with current trends in technology. And as it great as it will be to listen to Bill and I, we like to include students and faculty in our programs for interviews and insight about teaching and learning. Last year was our soft launch, and we recorded a few podcasts, which you can find on our faculty website, facultyhub.chemeketa.edu. We're using this episode, though, as our official launch and are excited to have Jessica Howard joining us, and we would love your input on future episodes. So if there's a topic of interest, or if you are doing something in the classroom that you would like to share with colleagues, we would love to interview you and have you on our show. We've had a few faculty in the past on our other episodes, and we definitely want to include faculty from all around the campus. So with that, Jessica is joining us for a Q&A so we can all get to know her. Bill and I have a few questions for her, but we would love to hear from all of you in the audience. So you can be brave and join us up here at the table. We have another microphone. Or on each of the tables, there are slips of paper. So if you would rather write out your question, someone from the Center of Academic Innovation will walk around and bring those up, and Jessica will answer those for you. So when we met with Jessica ahead of time to plan this, she told us that she wanted to have fun. So these don't have to be serious questions just about her background or teaching or things like that. You can ask her some fun questions. And like I said, Bill and I have a few questions of our own to ask you as well. So Jessica, thank you for joining us. Welcome to Chemeketa. We've heard that you've been on the talk show circuit with the Chemeketa Today the other day. Or sorry, Chemeketa Today. And you're joining us for Hub Talk. So recap for, actually, first thing. How do you like to be addressed, Dr. Howard or Jessica?
Jessica.
Okay. And recap for us where you came from and what your role was.
Okay, well, the last 7 years, I was at Portland Community College, Southeast Campus, which is at 82nd and Division, the newest, smallest campus at PCC. Although I wouldn't call it small. I was the campus president there, and I was tasked with bringing that center, it was a center when I arrived in 2012, into a comprehensive campus. And I was also over a workforce, essentially non-credit workforce, for the whole district for my first two to three years. So I did that, and then before that, I was at San Antonio College in San Antonio, Texas, which is one of the Alamo Colleges in the Alamo College District at San Antonio, and they're independently accredited colleges. And so I was the vice president of academic affairs and the executive vice president there. That's really where I started. I began as an adjunct faculty member and then became full-time faculty member and then a department chair, which is what we called it there. Was asked to join the dark side and become the interim vice president, which was really strange because I reported to a dean one day and he reported to me the next day. So that was super popular among the deans' decision.
Yeah. All right. So Jessica, share with us a little bit about your teaching background.
So I have a master's degree in music theory, bachelor's in music theory, bachelor's in music in English literature, and then a doctorate in performance studies, which is basically a kind of like a cultural studies, sort of kind of a cultural anthropology type degree from NYU. And so when I started teaching, I was teaching what I call academic music courses, non-performance music courses, so music theory, music literature, music survey courses, and also humanities survey courses. And I did those in the classroom and online, and that's when I started. And then when I became full-time, I was teaching courses for music majors, in addition to being the what we would call a program chair.
So with your background in music, would you say Beatles or Rolling Stones are your favorite?
Rolling Stones. I think the vibe, very different, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Do we have any questions on our slips of paper anywhere? We've got people roaming around, so just hold them
There's
up if you do.
Back there. And if you do want to come up to the microphone, just feel free to come on up, sit down, have a conversation with Jessica. Do you want to? You can go ahead and read them.
Okay.
They're for you.
Crash cymbal, vital part of the kit or useless annoyance? Vital part of the kit.
Okay.
Without question. That's what I would
say.
Okay.
Very good. Nice.
Very good.
Okay.
What was your most memorable classroom experience, learning or teaching? My most memorable classroom experience was as a student, and I was a master's student at the Shepherd School of Music at Rice University, and this very, very, very famous sort of great mind in the field of music theory and composition, Paul Cooper, was at the front of the room, and there were only four of us, and it was music composition, music theory, graduate students, and he was... very frustrated with us because he was trying to get us to say something that he was thinking, and we didn't know what he was thinking. And he kept saying, and he kept putting all this stuff on the board, and he would say, "What is it? What is the one thing that everything I've put on the board this term, that everything I put on the board has in common? What is the one thing? What is the one thing?" And we just had no idea what he was talking about. So I said, "Chalk." And then, and the other three in the room were just horrified, and I, you know, covered my mouth, and it was, I mean, I thought, that's it, you know, I mean, it's over, and he looked at me for this long moment, and then he threw back his head, and he laughed, and laughed, and laughed, and that was the end of that.
That's
I remember
awesome.
That, so the guess what I'm thinking thing can be just really, really off-putting.
Yeah, that's good, that's a good reminder for us.
Very good.
I don't know. He didn't tell us. It was chalk. I guess I got it right. I don't. Okay.
Oh, that's a good one right there.
What has been some of your best career advice? I haven't gotten any. No. You know, I think it's just to be authentic and to be true to yourself. Period. And then that way, even if people don't like maybe a decision that you make, they at least know who you are.
Right.
And you can talk to them. And it becomes a conversation and not something that someone did that no one knows who did it. And, you know, transparency is really important. So just being true to who I am. And I've always been a little concerned that I didn't have enough gravitas, right? And I would tell my mentors, you know, I don't think I'm serious enough. And they would say, you know what, you need to stay, you need to do what you do, and don't worry about that. So I have tried to do that, for better or for worse, I think.
Okay.
Want another one?
Yeah. What book do you recommend faculty read?
Ooh.
Like, is there
yes.
a good text?
Yes. I would say Bridges Out of Poverty by a very fabulous person who graduated from Mount Hood Community College as a woman who had experienced generational poverty and is now Donna Beagle. Thank you. Yeah, and you know, it's just a fascinating book because it talks about the three different languages that we speak in the United States: the language of poverty, the language of middle class, the language of high class, and all the things that you know and don't know. And I thought I would be able to kind of navigate all three lists, and I absolutely could not. And so it gives a whole different perspective to what it means to serve students who experience that kind of poverty. I still think about that book today. So I would say that one.
Okay. That's good from the info that you shared the other day. in your speech about the level of poverty that some of our students have, in especially in our district. Okay, here's a fun one. Do you have any pets? And if so, what are their names and ages? And what types of pets? You'd mentioned that you had a hamster.
Yeah, the hamster, as resilient as he was on the trip up, did not last much longer.
Oh, so sorry to hear that.
It was a bad day, but Henry, you know, he lived a good life. We have two large rescue dogs. One is named Jet, and one is named Cinnamon. And they are just really big and kind of fat. And they're about 9 years old. Cinnamon's 9 years old, and Jet is probably 5.
Okay. That's good. Thank you.
Yep.
So as a faculty member, were you a member of a union, and how do you feel about faculty associations and their role?
Right. Well, Texas is a right-to-work state. So when I was a faculty member, there was no union. There was no representative body. And I remember very clearly, you know, being an adjunct, part-time faculty in particular. And, you know, we just tried to volunteer for everything in the world. We didn't get paid for any of it, so that we could become more attractive as someone who might get hired. And that's how, actually, I entered the online space, because none of the music department folks, surprise, surprise, wanted to teach online. Anyway, they just weren't inclined, and it seemed like a foreign thing. So I just went and got trained on the professional development sequence to learn to be able to put things online through WebCT or through HTML and you know, all of it. And so I got really, really trained. I got trained for free, but of course I wasn't paid for any of that time. So I just, I became the person who always said yes, which meant that I wasn't paid for any of that. And yet it made me really viable, and I did end up getting that full-time job, which honestly I will say, in my entire career in academia, the largest jump I ever made was from adjunct to full-time. That was the one that was the hardest. There were 200 people competing with me. It was incredibly difficult. And once I did that, I felt like, you know, I had a pathway, but it was just fraught with, I don't know, so many people tried to do that and couldn't do that for one reason or another. So I am very sympathetic to the idea, to those folks out there who teach who don't have that kind of protection. So I value it. I was part of the Faculty Senate, which was the closest thing mm-hmm. we had to a body like that. And we were always advocating for faculty compensation and, you know, other faculty issues. And so I was vice chair of the Faculty Senate for 2 years. They elected me to be chair. I was a month from going in as chair, and that's when I got the call to go to the dark side.
Uh-huh.
Which, it was very weird, and the Faculty Senate was very angry.
Okay, so we have some more questions. If we don't get to all the questions that have been passed up, we are going to give these to Jessica to have her answer, and we are going to post them on our blog. So have no fear if we don't answer all of the questions. I do have a question for you just about, I know you've only been here 2 months, but what are some short-term goals that maybe you have for the college and where you would like to see us headed?
Well, for me personally, my goals are to listen and learn and really understand what Chemeketa is, what the culture is like, what the priorities are, what the issues are. You know, I'm in a learning curve. The worst thing I think a lot of new administrators can do is just go in and start making things the way they were at their prior institution or institutions. And I think that's the worst thing to do. I'm the newcomer. I need to listen and I need to learn. So that is my priority. Secondly, I think, you know, just like most academic institutions, we reflect sort of traditional categories of organization, right? We're very hierarchical, and we have credit in one basket, non-credit in another. We have departments that are distinct from each other. And so I think it's really important to increase the connections between these groups of people and these categories of teaching and learning so that we can anticipate the world of work to come. which is changing very, very dramatically, so we can do more interdisciplinary work, which I really believe in. And I think that increasing those connections would be the closest thing I would come to a goal this year. So we're going to be doing a lot around communication strategies and things like that.
Great. Okay, one last question, and then we're gonna transition here. What are you most excited about at the start of the school year? And I know it's being on Hub Talk, but beyond that, what are you most excited about?
The students. Yeah. The students. I mean, without a doubt. And, you know, I love the academic calendar, and fall is my favorite. It's just my favorite season. I think part of it's the weather, but a lot of it is just this is when it's a new start, right? And it just feels incredibly exciting. And this morning I was just welcoming the student leaders, and there are like 100 of them all in one room together. And it's just, I don't know, it represents a start and a start of many wonderful academic journeys. It's the students.
Yeah. Okay, great. So feel free to go ahead and write some more questions down. And like I said, we will share these with Jessica and she'll answer them all. Since we're celebrating our 50th anniversary, though, we thought it'd be great for Jessica to recap some of the top technologies over the past 50 years. And there were a lot of current technologies that we probably now take for granted, but the 1970s was one of the golden eras, marking the dawn of personal computing and video games. So from gadgets like the first digital watch to the classic Atari 2600 game system, there was no better time to hit up the arcade or plop down on the couch for a friendly round of Pong. I'd hate to see an unfriendly round of Pong.
I would too. But that would be bad.
So in her best rendition of a David Letterman top 10 list, here's our top 10 list of technologies from 1970, or pretty close to it. And if it was on the internet, it must be true. So take it away.
Number 10, the home VCR. Streaming media is the way of the times, but back in the day, big, bulky plastic tapes were how we binge-watched our favorite movies and shows that we recorded off TV. The home VCR was first developed in 1970, and early models easily cost over $1,000. A step or two behind digital media, but still a truly great invention in its time. The VCR helped to fuel the consumer video industry and video rental stores. The VCR pioneered the way of the Laserdisc and DVD in the years to follow, which are both bygone mediums as well.
Nice.
Number 9, the floppy disk. Created by Alan Shugart, the floppy disk was a revolutionary electronic storage medium. The first commercial floppy disks, developed in the late 60s, were 8 inches in diameter. They became commercially available in 1971 as a component of IBM products. They were then sold separately, beginning in 1972. The term floppy disk appeared in print as early as 1970, although IBM announced the media as the Type 1 diskette in 1973. Over the years, the size of the floppy decreased to 3.5 inches, and they were no longer floppy, although the industry continued to use the terms floppy disk. It wasn't until the mid-2000s when manufacturers discontinued providing floppy drives on computers because of other revolutionary storage devices like the zip disk and recordable CDs. Number 8.
If you really need some Type 1 diskettes, you can get them on eBay and get them within a week. Sorry, we threw you a curveball there. I know.
Yeah, to know that.
Okay, now number 8.
Number 8. Unix time. Unix time is a system of describing points in time. Wait, isn't that what a normal clock does too? Unix time was started on midnight of January 1, 1970. It counts seconds in coordinated universal time, which is abbreviated to UTC and is the primary standard by which the world regulates clocks and time. Unix enthusiasts have a history of holding time tea parties to celebrate significant values of the Unix time number. As the use of Unix time has spread, so has the practice of celebrating its milestones. Usually, it is time values that are round numbers in decimal that are celebrated, following the Unix convention of viewing those values in decimal. For example, isn't this riveting? In September 2001, the Unix biennium was celebrated. And yes, you guessed it. The name biennium is a combination of billion and millennium. Wow, these Unix people really know how to party. In 2009, the decimal representation of Unix time reached 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0 seconds, just like the number row on a keyboard.
Wow.
In some parts of the world, this day fell on Friday the 13th in the Gregorian calendar. Not sure if that was an omen or just some kind of coincidence.
Colin, are you hosting a Unix tea party anytime soon?
I may. Next time a nice decimal number rolls around, we'll invite the crowd.
Number 7, Pascal. I took a course in Pascal. I'm feeling very old now. Released in 1970, Pascal is a programming language designed by Nicholas Wirth as a small, efficient language intended to encourage good programming practices. And looking at the image on the screen, it is a very neat and tidy programming language. It is named in honor of the French mathematician, philosopher, and physicist Blaise Pascal. Pascal became very successful in the 1970s, notably in the developing mini computer market. It was also widely used as a teaching language in university-level programming courses and was also used for writing commercial software. Sadly, it was displaced by the C programming language during the 1980s. Number 6, email. It might be the bane of our existence, but in 1970, email truly was revolutionary. Ray Tomlinson is internationally known and credited as the inventor of email. He implemented the first email program on the Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPANET, system, the precursor to the internet. It was the first system able to send mail between users on different computers connected to ARPANET. Previously, mail could be sent only to people who use the same computer. By using the at sign to separate the username from the name of their machine, Tomlinson created a means for sending email to users on other computers. This design has been used in email addresses ever since. The Internet Hall of Fame, I didn't know there was such a thing, in its account of his work, commented, quote, Tomlinson's email program brought about a complete revolution, fundamentally changing the way people communicate. And now you know there's an Internet Hall of Fame. Number 5, the Random Access Memory Chip. Back in 1970, the newly formed Intel company publicly released the 1103, the first DRAM, Dynamic Random Access Memory Chip. With a whopping capacity of 1 kilobit, it was the best-selling semiconductor memory chip in the world by 1972. The first commercially available computer using the 1103 was the HP 9800 series. RAM stands for Random Access Memory, memory that can be accessed or written randomly, so any byte or piece of memory can be used without accessing the other bytes or pieces of memory. There were two basic types of RAM at the time, dynamic RAM, or DRAM, and static RAM, or SRAM. DRAM must be refreshed thousands of times per second. SRAM is faster because it does not have to be refreshed.
I know, this is riveting too.
Wow. One kilobit is equal to 125 bytes, which might have been a lot back then, but think about that we have storage capacities up to terabytes now.
The laser.
Number 4, the TEA CO2 laser. Long before Dr. Evil and his laser, the carbon dioxide laser was invented in the late 1960s by Jacques Beaulieu, working at the Defense Research and Development Canada in Quebec. There we go. The French just completely threw me off. Besides being the weapon of choice for sci-fi space travel, the laser does have a practical application on Earth. TEA CO2 lasers are used extensively for product marketing. A logo, serial number, or best before date is marked onto a variety of packaging materials by passing the laser light through a mask containing the information and focusing it down to an intensity which ablates the material to be marked. CO2 lasers are also used for surface preparation in industrial environments like paint stripping, in aircraft maintenance, cleaning of surfaces for painting and gluing, removal of coating layers for bonding or welding, and wear-free cleaning of molds and tools like tire molds and molds to produce automotive interior parts.
There will be a test on all this at the end.
Number three, the liquid crystal display. It might not be the iWatch, but the Pulsar P1 was the first ever digital watch encased in 18-karat gold. It cost $2,100 back in the early 1970s. In 1970, George Gray and his colleagues working at Hull University developed stable liquid crystal materials whose optical characteristics could be controlled by voltage rather than heat, enabling the development of practical liquid crystal displays. Nowadays, LCDs are used in digital watches, televisions, computers, calculators, video game monitors, cockpit displays, digital signs, and telephones. That's a good-looking watch right up there.
I know. Oh, go back one, Sage. We lost number two.
There it is.
Number two, the laser printer. The original laser printer was called Ethernet, Alto Research Character Generator, Scanned Laser Output Terminal, or EARS. And here I thought Chemeket had a lot of acronyms. EARS later became the Xerox 9700 laser printer as shown on the screen. Development of the laser printer began in 1969 at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center and was completed in November 1971. They probably didn't need to heat that room because of the size of that contraption, and I'm pretty sure that model didn't have Wi-Fi or color capability.
Just skip that. We'll just go right to that.
We'll just go right to number one, the Apollo space program. It was 50 years ago this year that Apollo 11 landed on the moon. And although it is not a specific technology per se, the Apollo missions did have a major effect on the world, rapidly accelerating the pace of technology development. The work of NASA engineers at the time caused a dramatic shift in electronics and computing systems. NASA scientists pioneered more than 6,300 technologies that are now routinely used in day-to-day living. I know you are dying to know all 6,300 technologies, but here are three of them. The computer microchip. Modern microchips descend from integrated circuits used in the Apollo guidance computer. The joystick. This popular computer gaming device was first used on the Apollo lunar rover. And satellite television. This technology was used to fix errors in spacecraft signals and reduce scrambled pictures and sound in satellite television signals. And there you have the top 10 technologies from 1970.
Well, thank you for joining us and for allowing us to get to know you and for reading the top 10 list. We did have, you handled the technical glitch as well. We have a video clip of the moon landing, which didn't really work out. It got out of sequence there, but thank you for doing the top 10 list. And we're going to transition into just a short lightning round section where some of the faculty from the Center for Academic Innovation are going to share a few things, and then we will take a break and then move into our breakout sessions, and they're going to combine the rooms, separate the rooms and all that. So Jessica, thank you for joining us. You're free.
Thank you
You're,
for having
feel free
me.
To hang out and learn
thank
about
you.
Some technology.
Thank you.
Pub Talk is produced by the Center for Academic Innovation at Chemeketa Community College. Visit our website, facultyhub.chemeketa.edu, to find helpful resources about teaching, learning, and technology integration, along with video tutorials and more podcast episodes just like this one.